This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
In today's podcast, we explain, how do you get into hormones and health optimization? How can an ER doctor do hormones better than the urologist that he's seen? And how we met Dr. Tom Egan, an MD that we've worked with several years. We certainly bonded over our mutual love of more plates, more dates. And in today's podcast, we talk about a lot of things from testosterone to GLP-1s. So stay tuned. Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast, where we give you tools to develop a balanced approach for health. I'm Dr. Kyle Gillette.
And I'm James O'Hara, nurse practitioner. And today we're joined in person, a very special guest, Dr. Thomas Egan.
Well, thanks, James. Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you.
Yeah. And for people who are wondering, we did not regress into our previous studio setup. We just happened to be on the same side of the table again. So we'll continue on with the new studio setup. But as always, give us feedback on how you like this. And if there's any other changes that we should make, hopefully the audio and the video is much better. But yeah, we have lots of questions to ask you. I know that James has done a podcast with you before.
Yep. It was fun.
Yeah. But what a lot of people are probably wondering is how did the three of us end up in the same room? And I guess past that, how would someone end up in the same spot? Because that's a question that we get pretty frequently, is how to educate yourself or how to seek out good evidence-based information.
Oh, yeah. People ask about resources or how do I do what you do? So how do you do what you do?
So I guess I would start by explaining that question of how did we all get in the same room? And for me, that goes back some years where I wasn't feeling great at all. And I wondered, is this low testosterone? And I went to see my own primary care doctor, who is still my primary care doctor. He's a great guy. And moreover, he is a fan of what we do. He appreciates it. And at this point, like, I don't get labs to my primary care doctor. I just run our lab panels and bring them to him. But anyway, I went to see him and I said, hey, Eric, I'm not feeling great. Do you think you could check some testosterone levels on me? And again, this was some years ago at this point. So he did. And even though it's years later, I don't remember my free T, but I do remember my total T. I remember the exact number. It was 218. And I said, can I go on some testosterone? And he's like, oh, Tom, he goes, you know, you're technically within normal limits and testosterone decreases with age. And we all know that technically he's right. The normal range runs from the low 200s to 850 for total T. And, but, you know, we could get into it more later, I suppose, but that's not our philosophy. You know, I don't think you have to accept a testosterone in the 200s if you feel terrible. And he said, well, you know, Tom, maybe, you know, you've got a tough job. You know, you're married late, you got young kids, even though you're older and you're tired and maybe you're depressed. I'm like, I'm not depressed. I don't feel well. So he didn't want to do it. So I went out and got on TRT myself and pretty quickly realized that even as a physician, I had made the mistake of sort of stumbling into a TRT mill.
Did you get your money back if you weren't satisfied?
I don't remember. No. So they did treat me. They treated me effectively, but it was very cookie cutter, you know, and that bothered me. And I just said, wait, I can do this better myself. And I didn't really know how to go about it, but I was a lifelong gym rat. You know, I was in gyms around, you know, bodybuilding and powerlifting since I was maybe 13. And so although I was never in my youth a steroid person or a gear guy, truth is I had a lot of friends who were, and I was very familiar with the environment, and I sort of understood how it worked. And then I started researching, and I taught myself a lot, I think, to the point where, I don't know, maybe my ego was big enough that I thought, well, why aren't I working in this segment of medicine? And as I researched, I also realized there's a lot more to it. It's not just TRT. Mm-hmm. It's what we do here, you know, health optimization and trying to help people live long but also powerful lives. And I just got more and more mesmerized or obsessed, maybe isn't a healthy word, but, and then as you guys know, I was sitting with my wife one night, watching some YouTube health videos, and I said, it wasn't you guys who I was watching, but I said,
why not?
Well, the lucky part is you guys were affiliated with that clinic. And I said to my wife, I said, I would like to work with them. And she said, well, why shouldn't you? And so it all turned, like, I just kind of said, well, the worst I can do is laugh and say, no, you're not qualified and we don't need your help. And so Yvonne said, go ahead, send them an email. And I did. And I very quickly got a response from Kyle. And then I met James and worked with them for several years with that clinic, and when it became clear that you guys were going to create Gillette Health, which was a specific vision that wasn't exactly the same as what we were all doing before, I said to myself, if they'll have me, I'm coming with.
Yeah, and to be clear, you did leave the other clinic first before you knew that we were.
That is true. We could also say, I had the opportunity to stay. But, and it is nothing against the other clinic. It's just that what you two were going to build was really something I really wanted to be associated with. And as you two well know, over the past few years, you've continued to teach me a tremendous amount. And you know, I think what we all are doing here at Gillette Health is it's the future of medicine. And, you know, relatively speaking, you know, sort of chronologically, I'm the old man of Gillette Health, and I feel very happy to have the opportunity to do what we're doing at this stage in my career. You know, it keeps me young and interested simply by what we do, because it's always so much to do, always so much to learn, and it's exciting.
There's an endless amount of learning to be done. We all learn from each other. You know, you've taught us things, and we've shared things we've come across, And it sounds like it, in its simplest form, you're an innovator where you saw an inefficient system. Maybe it's efficient to be a cookie cutter, but a system that could be improved upon. And then you're like, oh, I want to like make this better. I can do this better than it's currently being done, which is a pattern you see in a lot of people who start something or collaborate and create a process that's better than the old one. So it's really interesting. And we can maybe chat about some of those cookie cutter clinics. And you referenced a radio ad, which I don't think we've clued you in on, but we wanted to kind of surprise you. So you can kind of tell Dr. Egan a bit about how that radio ad goes for a TRT clinic.
Yeah, this is kind of how I imagine whatever the cookie cutter clinics in Massachusetts are like on the radio or Facebook ads or whatnot. But there's a clinic local to Kansas City that advertises TRT and HGH, which shocked me, apparently for everyone. TRT and HGH shots, your first visit, we inject you. If you're not happy, your money back. So you walk in and your first visit, you get both. So then if you have, you know, swelling or, you know, an adverse effect or anything,
or
if you feel good, you have no idea which one of the shots did it.
I'm speechless. That is so awful.
When you first told me about it, I thought it was like satire. I was like, oh, you're like, yeah, using exaggeration to make it funny that this is what TRT clinics do. And you're like, nope, that's an actual radio ad.
Yeah. And is it like $99 a visit too?
Probably. I know there's a lot of med spas that advertise $99 your first month, but then it's $299 or $399, which if you know anything about GLP-1s, which is basically you're in that low dose for the long haul, that basically incentivizes the opposite.
Yeah, there's, I mean, numbers, some clinics do it X per month. I saw one advertising GLP-1, no doctor's visit required, and you get prescribed compounded GLP-1.
Was it the gym that we go to that advertises it?
No.
They just have an NP or a PA.
No, this was something somebody shared on social media, but other
GLP-1 program.
Your gym does?
Yeah. It's Lifetime Fitness. They have a GLP-1 program.
Really?
Yeah, national chain of gyms. And almost everyone does now.
And who or whom, pardon my grammar, is the medical control for all of this?
I don't know.
It's probably
independently contracted NPs and
they
PAs.
Probably operate as a health platform.
They're
that connects patients or gym members with independent prescribers. But if those prescribers are not giving people the prescriptions, then
they will not
there's not a business model there. So
yep.
It kind of makes you wonder how independent are these. Other ways they try to get you are somehow or another, one of these clinics got my phone number, and I've gotten 3 text messages over the last few months. 25% off today only. Testosterone and HGH program. Hurry, promo ends today. And then that's not where they stopped. So it wasn't for today only. They said 29% off. Leap year special.
I love it.
And then the last one,
that was funny.
This is actually Wednesday. They sent me this one. 30% off. Testosterone and HGH therapy. MD supervised. Telemedicine. Reply HGH 30.
And, you know,
they can tell that I have low HGH just because of my Google search history, or I don't know.
Your Google Scholar search history?
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah.
And, you know, we spend all this time, or at least I spend a lot of time with our patients, especially at the beginning, explaining to them, why do I want all these labs before we do anything? Because I need to get a baseline idea of your health. And it's not, as we all know, labs aren't the only thing, but we are data driven, you know, and I explain to people, Yeah, I think we can probably, you probably are a candidate for TRT or for a woman. You probably are a candidate for HRT or either. You might be a candidate for semaglutide or tirzepatide or whatever. But I need to know a lot more about your metabolism, the state of your hormones, your cardiovascular risk factors before we do any of that. And then, you know, you guys are sitting here regaling me with tales of people that, you know, just give me your credit card and here you go.
Huge spectrum of clinics out there. And people are feeding their families. There's all kinds of business models out there.
It's those darn organ systems that hormones and medications have an effect on.
Your cardiovascular system hates this one trick.
Yeah. So it's every organ system in the body that you should be thinking about or be familiar with. Not that you have to explain the effects of whatever medication or hormone in every single organ system in the body.
Right.
But at least the most pertinent positives and negatives. Like that study that had the secret shopper for TRT clinics.
Oh, yeah. They went down a checklist, and I might be able to pull this up.
We'll post it if we can pull up that chart.
But I know one of the things was the person went in with a normal testosterone level, and one of the questions was, were you offered testosterone, yes or no? What was the stated goal, the testosterone level? Did they ask about fertility? Did they ask any past medical history, specifically medical history of cardiovascular disease? And I think it was like one out of seven clinics got good marks. But then it also asked, what additional medications were you offered? And it was everything from BPC to Cialis to CMAX, all sorts of peptides, these sorts of things that were just sort of add-ons. So it's just someone going in with a normal testosterone level, do I need TRT? And then what actually happens in those visits? And six out of seven, it looked pretty bad.
By the way, where do you think they were getting where do you think these clinics get HGH? Is it actual Omnitrope or Norditropin?
Well, the actual stuff is kind of expensive. So
yeah.
I don't know.
I legitimately do not know. Yeah, let's see. The secret shopper, they asked
if the visit was with anybody with a license.
Yeah.
So most of them had at least someone with a license, a physician, nurse practitioner, PA.
One of them was a non-medically licensed individual.
Yeah.
I could think of some that do that. I don't need to name names, but all of the other ones were NPs or PAs. And some of them did ask questions about cardiovascular risk, social history, recent use of or history of testosterone therapy use. Most of them did not. One of them asked about desire for future fertility. So that's good.
One out of seven?
Yeah. You know, glass quarter full, glass seventh full. I'm an optimistic type of a person. Goals.
Who ran the study?
I don't know. We'll post the full study link as well. But I'm not really talking to the mic here, but I don't know if it says in the figure. But we'll post this.
Yeah, I want to say it was posted in JAMA maybe, but we'll put the link to it in the description. But basically, it was just sort of putting out there, hey, this is going on, and it's sort of the Wild West. It doesn't appear that, at least as of now, that the FDA or any DEA, any kind of body like that, is going after and saying, hey, this can't go on. Mm-hmm. Even though some of these clinics are quite large at this point in time.
Yeah. As a freedom-loving individual, there is certain criteria that are good for freedoms in the long run because they keep industries working without harming huge groups of people. So there's certainly a balance. And part of it's complicated in that there's no specialty for this. If you see an endocrinologist, whether it's for hormones or if you see an obesity medicine professional, even an ABOM certified obesity medicine professional, then you're certainly not guaranteed results. And if the average American who's metabolically unhealthy and, you know, probably if, you know, you're looking at certain age groups, menopausal females, certainly if they start an HRT regimen and if they have metabolic syndrome, start a little bit of a GLP-1, they will probably have better results than listening to an average dietitian or nutritionist that tells them that they need to eat more because they have metabolic damage.
Reset your metabolism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it would be interesting to see, you know, there is some regulation around testosterone because it's a controlled substance. Some of the weight loss medications as well, like phentermine. If having potential for abuse or misuse is a criteria, it would be very interesting to see the tune that the obesity medicine societies would be, you know, saying if you slapped a Schedule 4 on semaglutide. Mm-hmm. They would say, wait, no, you can't do that. You're marginalizing populations. Whereas with testosterone, they're like, oh, yeah, good. It should be controlled. People shouldn't have easy access to it. But if you take a drug that probably causes more short-term side effects as far as like, more than half of people getting nauseous, quarter of people throwing up on it, you know, risk of dehydration. Definitely on the front end, there are some risks there.
Yep.
They would sort of scream, this is unfair, you can't do this. It makes their lives harder.
Yep. And, you know, and I know you guys know, but maybe the average person watching this podcast doesn't know the number of like otherwise really sophisticated physicians in the U.S. who are just knee-jerk like, TRT? No, that's bad. It's going to make you have a heart attack.
Yeah.
Okay.
How many heart attacks has Barry Bonds had now? Or Mark McGuire?
I don't know.
I think even Arnold's was a valve surgery. It wasn't actually a heart attack.
It was a valve surgery. And he had a valve surgery, and then he went back to the OR. And I was working in a hospital, and one of the cardiologists there, he said anyway that he knew Arnold's cardiologist, and that the reason he had to go back was because he blew out the new valve because he went back to the gym too quickly. Now, that's third
hearsay, audio, sure. You
know, so, but that was the story I was told.
And to be clear, I'm not saying that, you know, there's no cardiovascular risk with TRT.
We've discussed this at length.
Basically, if blood pressure goes up and your lipids are skewed, then there's potential for risk. Even if the New England Journal of Medicine paper says no significant risk associated with TRT.
Right. Yeah, but I think, and I don't know whether it's physicians, certain members of the general public, I think they mistake what some bodybuilders do for TRT. And if you do some of the things that some bodybuilders do, your risk for really early heart disease and liver problems and messing up your lipids can be big. But I think a lot of those men and women, people have told them the risks they're taking and they choose to take it anyway, which I think that risk with properly managed TRT is much lower.
Yeah.
Now, what about free access to medication? So the birth control pill, O-pill, has gone over the counter. Mm-hmm. And don't believe it was released at the time we're recording this. So this will be new to you as well. I know you're an avid listener to the Gillette Health podcast, but the O-pill came out over the counter. And then two sort of op-eds were written subsequently shortly after that saying that, well, if this is over the counter, then A and B should be over the counter as well. A being 5-mg rosuvastatin and B being SSRIs. Now, I could see a case being made for low dose of a statin. It's over the counter already with red yeast rice, you know, we kind of talked about. But SSRI, in your experience, I'm sure in the ER you've seen someone come in manic post starting an SSRI.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to hear your insight, having been in this field and sort of would be on the front lines of the negatives of that, like increased suicidality, and manic episodes, what your thoughts are on statins, SSRIs, things being over the counter.
Well, I might not end up giving you the answer like that you're looking for in terms of a dramatic, well, I'm not saying you are looking, but I'm on the fence is my honest answer, because you can look at countries in Europe where so many things that are, you know, DEA and or FDA regulated here are, you can just walk into a pharmacy and buy them, like a lot of antibiotics. There's that ever existing conflict between freedom and security. You know what I mean? If you don't ever want to get hurt, you're going to give up all of your freedoms. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be completely free, there's going to be occasional really bad outcomes. So I'm going to cop out and say, for me, it probably really depends on the medicine. I'd be more inclined to say yes to antibiotics, particularly antibiotics that have been around for 40, 50 years, and a lot of people may have even heard of them, versus SSRIs, like you said. I have seen that. I have seen serotonin syndrome. It's not pretty. It's dangerous. And it can be hard to fix.
So if you make it all legal, don't put the SSRI right next to the MAO inhibitor.
And your St. John's wort.
Yeah, put them all together. Yeah, no, I think that's a good take. And that's a lot of the nuance that we discussed in the unreleased episode as well. That, there's a lot of benefit to things being over the counter, including the O-pill and including topical estrogen. In the UK, I think that Estrace should be over the counter.
And then
the United States, for sure, that's an easy one.
A logical extension of this line of conversation is supplements. They are drugs.
Yep.
Like, you know, and you know, there are certain supplements that are like really potent CYP450, either inhibitors or agonists. And people don't know that, you know. And then they're on some medication and they go out and they get berberine. Mm-hmm. And they start taking it and they don't know that it's going to affect the other medication that they're already on. Mm-hmm. So should all supplements, or should supplements be much more regulated than they are?
Even food. If we really want people to be safe, we need to get that grapefruit juice off of the grocery store shelves.
Yeah.
What you create then is a black market for grapefruit juice, yep, or for supplements.
Mm-hmm. Don't forget about the alcohol.
What's the problem with alcohol?
Did we try that before? Taking that, making it not OTC.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've seen a lot of people intoxicated on alcohol in the ER.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We tried that before, didn't we? Didn't work so well.
Yeah. Prohibition.
Yeah. That's what it was. So there's certainly a lot of merit to having things within reason be over the counter, but informed public health decisions about what forms of those is important.
Yep. True.
Yeah. The nuance there is like when I think they're backtracking now on the Portland drug decriminalization experiment. I think in some countries they did see some positive results where they had these safe centers. Mm-hmm. People could go in, have an overdose reversed if something like that arose. Mm-hmm. And then Portland said, what if we do that without the safety part? And now they're sort of backtracking.
Yeah, I think I've seen some YouTube videos on that where the problem is that they give a bunch of free stuff and decriminalize stuff, but they don't improve the safety. Or they try to, but it's really a lot of it, the culture and the people. In certain areas, there's just always going to be a culture of unsafety, which is more of a sociology political topic.
Yeah. But who knew today was a sociology podcast?
Yeah. Another thing that is sort of tangentially related, at least to, you know, the seeking out of hormone replacement or the seeking out of GLP-1s, basically anything just outside of alternative medicine is where to go to get education. So I was just thinking between the three of us, how many A4M certifications and modules we have, how many IFM modules and certifications we have. You know, did we go back to certain fellowships or endocrinology programs or Harvard certificates or anything like that? And I don't think we have any between the three of us.
I don't think I have any A4M, IFM certificates.
No.
And there's really not secrets that they have. These things are there in the clinical literature. Certainly, they share some interesting clinical experiences and interesting opinions on things, sometimes right, sometimes maybe a bit far-fetched. But even in our practice, there's nothing that's really a secret. It's all out there somewhere. There's just nobody sort of spoon-feeding this sort of thing to, you know, doctors, nurse practitioners who want to learn.
Yeah, and maybe I'm being overly cynical, but I have been an ER doc for 20 years, so that would explain a lot. But the other thing you have to, I consider when I think about that issue is that specialty care in the U.S. is a guild system. Mm-hmm. So each guild wants to protect its knowledge base. And you know, I'm not going to do it because my interest in expanding and learning in medicine is this. It's us. It's what we do. But there, you know, for years and years and years, many emergency medicine trained physicians wanted to get board certified in critical care. And it simply was not allowed. You could not get into a critical care fellowship from the emergency department. I think that's changing. You know, so I don't want to sit here on a podcast and then have people calling you guys and say, oh, he doesn't know that. Because I do think it's changing. But back when I was coming out of emergency medicine residency, if you wanted to be critical care, you had to be surgery, anesthesia, or IM. And otherwise you weren't getting in. So, you know, when you guys are talking about, you know, there should be information sharing. We should be able to identify how physicians can, where are the sources for physicians to learn, and even the general public, although you got to be really careful, as we all know with Dr. Google. But for a long time, information was guarded. Like, it was siloed. Like, if you're not in this specialty, it's not, you know, we're not going to really share the knowledge base with you. You can consult with us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at least for one specialty, endocrinology. I know that our friend Derek has led to a lot of gnashing of teeth for endocrinologists. I'm sure there's many all over the country that have realized they need to go re-educate themselves
for the better.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a patient that has been a more plates, more dates follower for a year, 2 years, 5 years, and watched a lot of his videos, that endocrinologist, if they are not well prepared for the conversation, they can and probably should walk away feeling a little bit embarrassed about their level of knowledge and someone asking intelligent questions about their health and hormones.
Right. Well, you know, that's one of the things I like about our practices, because a lot of our patients are that way. They're going to come prepared and they're going to ask you challenging questions, and you better be ready for it, or at least not surprised by it. I mean, I have definitely been asked questions by some of our patients that I did not know the answer to at the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know, but I'm going to figure it out and I'll get back to you. And they were satisfied with that.
Yeah. If I don't know something, I usually just tell them to try keto.
try 12 months of strict keto before doing anything else.
Yeah. Kidding aside, but there are people who preach keto this, keto that. And I always find that kind of amusing because, yeah, maybe it works great for them and that's their lived experience, but certainly not for everyone.
Well, I mean, the biggest problem with keto is it's not sustainable. You can't, I mean, I personally don't think you can do keto forever.
Yeah. The people who do well on keto tend to have a very high level of enjoyment and adherence to a difficult regimen. I eating relatively low carb, relatively easy for me. Eating pure keto for myself personally is pretty difficult. If I had a benign brain tumor or if I had epilepsy, then perhaps I would be slightly better at adhering to a ketogenic diet, given that there's some
higher stakes.
Yeah, some higher stakes and some more potential benefit. But I'm, most people are more harmed by ultra-restrictive diets regardless of the ultra-restrictive diet.
Well, and I've had patients who have tried keto for weight loss and gained weight. They're like, well, I found out I could eat as much bacon as I wanted to, and it's keto, relatively high fat, a little bit of protein in there.
Yeah.
And the foods can be very tasty on a keto diet. It is restrictive, but I think it's sometimes sold as something that somehow cheats calories in, calories out. Like, eat all the bacon you want, eat all the grease you want, and you're still going to lose weight.
Can you get a payment plan for that bacon?
Eating keto can be expensive too.
You can get a payment plan for just about anything now. I actually found this out the other day. You can finance a Chipotle burrito bowl over 4 payments with Affirm. This is not an ad for Affirm, not a sponsor of the podcast, just the one that I happened to see there.
Yep.
But you can not only finance that, our media guy told us that there is a TRT pellet that you can also finance?
Yeah, Cameron found it. It's either TRT pellets or TRT plus HGH injections. It might be pellets. By the way, a lot of ER docs that open TRT clinics do love doing the pellets. And, you know, take a weekend course.
I can tell you. I can tell you why, but
yeah. My take on that is always the same. I might do that to an animal for the convenience, but I wouldn't do that to a human.
I don't.
So you're pro pellet
for animals? Absolutely. I don't want to have to give my dog TRT shots like once a week, twice a week. I'd rather just.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Yeah. What do you do if you do your pellet on a payment plan?
Yeah. So we were talking about that. That's so I assume
it's an actual sign, your payment plan for your TRT.
Yeah. If you default on your TRT payment plan, what happens?
So there was a movie in the last 10 years about, it was similar. It was a movie and it was about a guy who repossessed organ transplants.
Ah.
So it was funny. It was also macabre. You know, it was violent.
Was this a documentary?
No, it was a movie, and the plot was
Idiocracy.
Is that not the one?
No,
that's not the one.
Dog the Bounty Hunter.
You default on your pellet payment. Somebody come with a switchblade and dig the pellets out. How do you repossess the pellets? That's what I'm saying.
Like, well, you've paid for 4 of these, so you can keep those. So I'm taking back the other 8. I don't know how many they put in.
Yeah,
usually too many.
So is it the bank or the TRT clinic that needs to hire the repo guy?
I guess those intermediary services function more like a bank.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Well, that I know of, I wonder if anybody's actually had their pellet repossessed. One hack to get cheap TRT. Do a payment plan, stop paying the payment plan, and you can keep your pellet, maybe. This is not medical advice or financial advice.
You're going to make us really popular with that one.
Friends don't let friends do pellets. Right. So subcutaneously administered hormones, which you can subcutaneously administer estrogen.
Yeah, of course.
Which a lot of people don't realize that.
I mean, you know, there's
and there's nice pharmacokinetic data on that. That's what I like to see. You can actually see, hey, this has been studied. This much gets injected. It yields a blood level of this. It lasts this long. And these are averages, of course.
And it's not new. Like how long?
Very old data. Yeah.
I mean, how long has there been implantable birth control around? Long time now.
Yeah, really long time. If we didn't have estradiol patches, then estradiol valerate and cypionate would be super popular.
Yeah, nearly impossible to, I don't even know if they have commercial estradiol cypionate. The valerate's the only thing that I've found people to have in stock at commercial pharmacies now.
Yeah, brand name estradiol cypionate's just Depo Estradiol, Depo E. And I believe it was also a Pfizer product, but yeah, it might be one of those things like brand name Cialis that just literally no longer exists. Yeah, I guess, what do you think other ER doctors, what's their line of thinking? How did you go differently than what a lot of people do as they transition to, health optimization or preventive medicine? Because it seems like a lot of them do just end up opening a pellet clinic or opening a TRT clinic, doing a weekend course, and they really get stagnant. I've got to think that the passion and the actual interest in the subject is one of the variables.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I would give you an aside. And this is sort of anecdotal, but I mean, I've been an ER doc for 20 years. I know a lot of ER docs. They are going into TRT and health optimization, but more often they go into aesthetics.
Mm.
You know, and that really is like a weekend or a week course, and then you're out, you know, filling people's lips and getting rid of the wrinkles in their foreheads. And I think more ER docs do that than TRT.
Yeah.
And, I'll just give you a little anecdote. I was literally, because, you know, maybe the viewing public doesn't know, all of my patients know that I'm still currently working as an ER doc. I was at work last weekend. And PA that I was working with, and he's very strong. He's probably stronger than a lot of docs I know. We had a second PA with us that was triple coverage that day, and the other PA was asking about my non-ER job, and I started to explain to him, and the other guy kicked in that, oh, he gets paid to fix people's erectile dysfunction. That's what he does. You know, so very simplistic, like he was trying to like needle me a little. But I didn't have any of it. I took the other guy aside and I said, this is what we really do. And I gave him some cool HIPAA safe case examples, not just mine. One of them was yours, you know, like this is the kind of stuff we do. And he's like, yeah, wow, that sounds really cool. But I think the people that just open it up and don't get deeper and broader and in terms of their knowledge base, as you say, they're not really passionate about it. Like, you know, we've had this discussion before, not in a podcast, but, you know, like I believe that like I should be able to reinvent myself in my 50s. I should be able to be relatively young, strong, virile, energetic, and I want to be that way. And when my patients come to me and they're like, well, this is what I want, doc, I'm like, well, you know what? You're entitled to try to get it. Like there's nobody can ever promise you, like, I'm going to turn you into, you know, Superman or Conan the Barbarian or Albert Einstein, you know, depending on what your angle is, what you want. But yeah, we can certainly help you get as close as we can to that. And I think the people that are just like opening the clinics and just cookie cuttering it. They're very burnt out with what they're already doing, and they want a way to make a living that is simple and low stress. And that's why they keep their clinics simple and low stress. Yeah. I mean, I don't feel a whole lot of stress working for Gillette Health other than time crunch because I'm still trying to wind down in the ER. But, you know, there are a lot of people, like, what we do is not simple.
Yeah.
And if I, like, I'm constantly paying attention because it's a healthy fear, but I live in fear of not being able to keep up or making some kind of mistake. But that fear motivates me to, like, stay interested in and you know, learn more and keep expanding my knowledge base. And I think just people get tired and they just don't want to do that anymore. And so how much can you learn about aesthetics? Like, once you can do a lip, it's a matter of repetition. The problem there, I think, is the training is inadequate. You know, my wife will freely admit to anybody who asks that she does indulge in cosmetic surgery and stuff like that. Our dermatologist, the guy is an absolute artist. I've watched him work. Not everybody's an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our good friend.
Did any of what I just said make any sense at all?
People are more contractors.
Yeah. There's a dichotomy between people who do it because it's what they love and that would be their hobby otherwise. If we're thinking about the Venn diagrams that we have overlapping, you have that you don't judge bodybuilders for what they do. You're kind of like familiar with that culture. And you like Rich Froning, the CrossFit guy. That seems like a cool guy. Maybe we could podcast with him sometime. That'd be sweet. So you have these things that certainly make you interested in human performance and, you know, cognitive health. And like you said, you're just a better version of yourself. You're not Albert Einstein or Arnold or whatnot or Chris Bumstead, unless you take the same steroid cycle as Chris Bumstead.
He won't tell you what it is, though.
Because then you will be.
Yeah, then you might work even harder than him and be even bigger and better than him.
Yeah, but certainly within any field. And Alec McCarthy would say this too, the regenerative medicine PhD. We've had him on the podcast a couple times. That there's people who do aesthetics and any other field of medicine because they really enjoy it and they become good at it and it's artistry. And then there's people that do it because you can do it very quickly and make pretty good money doing it. So, yep. Yeah. But yeah, it's the same in this field and the ratios are probably different, but I would say fewer than 10% of clinics and providers in both of those fields are doing it because they have a particular interest. So we like to have our dysfunctional medicine podcast, but at the end of the day, our clinic does functional medicine, hormones, and aesthetics, which is three of the biggest red flags for any clinic that you go to. Mm-hmm. But we just happen to do it differently than other clinics that do that.
Yeah. You mentioned this not too long ago on a podcast. It's like, you know, what do you even want to call yourself as a clinic now with so many names being, you know, tainted with scams, you know, functional medicine or a longevity clinic or a TRT clinic. And you kind of just don't want to, you know, call it anything. It's like, well, you know, we do a lot of these things and, you know, we call it individualized medicine. So hopefully people don't start cheapening that brand. But I don't think it matters because we have, I mean, most of our, you know, referrals now are word of mouth. People are just very happy with how they've seen their health trajectories change. And the fact that we are able to keep up and, you know, spin out a reply in a few business days about this recent article that shows fasting linked to a 91% increase in heart disease or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, that people know, okay, I have some guidance whenever I hear these things come out that seem like I should be worried or that they're a bit far-fetched, and these guys can tell me, you know, what is what in that field. That makes me feel good about my long-term cognitive health, having to challenge myself. If I worked at a cookie cutter clinic, I would feel more apprehensive about my risk for dementia.
Yeah. Unless you do CrossFit, then the hormesis from the little micro trauma from headstand push-ups?
I've got one on this. This is a kind of a make it or break it moment for CrossFit. They've, you know, recently taken over by a corporation.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of claims that CrossFit is safe and effective. Have you ever seen a CrossFitter injury in the ER?
Yes.
Write that down. Write that down.
Write it down.
More than one.
Yeah. There's almost a whether it's running or CrossFit or maybe not so much running.
Lifting regular old weights.
Yeah.
People are going to get injured and tweaked from time to time.
There is ego lifting, which increases your risk of injury. There's ego running, which definitely increases your risk of injury. And then there's ego CrossFit, which is those two put together and then multiplied. A lot of people that do CrossFit, when I started it, I took 6 months and I took it easy. And I didn't have any injuries, even though I was a newbie and didn't know how to do any of the movements and had much worse mobility and flexibility than I do now. But ego CrossFit has got to be a really high risk activity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the paper I've cited and was subsequently a little bit chastised for by CrossFitters was that men in CrossFit take less advice from the trainers and have a higher injury rate than women in CrossFit. And I was like, hey, that
makes sense.
I was like, I could see that.
Being a guy and being married to a woman in my personal experience, yes, that would make
sense. Yeah. That being said, but certainly if you're if you enjoy rich frowning content or whatnot, then I guess, what do you think the merits of a functional fitness type modality is compared? And what are your thoughts on how that could be very easily improved?
Well, I mean, you know, I think what you're maybe I'm oversimplifying, but I do think we're kind of talking about CrossFit, right?
Yeah.
So my problem with CrossFit for the average person is it seems like CrossFit training for the average person walking in off the street, they're trying to do too much in the sense of the way the training combines, you know, strength, endurance, proprioception, balance, you know, and they're like, I see people doing exercises that combine all of those aspects, and maybe I'm misinterpreting CrossFit, but that's the way I view it. And I think if people could get a little more fundamental fitness before, like, just, okay, you're not really ready to do these things that are this complex. Mm-hmm. A lot of it looks to me, and the injuries that I've seen, a lot of it looks to me to the injuries come from either repetitive motion or weighted ballistics.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think the average person walking off the street is asking for injury if they do some of those weighted ballistics exercises early before they have even a little bit of baseline fitness and sort of a sense of their own body and a sense of the exercise. Does that make sense? Or am I just way off from answering your question? I don't know.
I think about it similarly. There is a scaling option for everyone. So that's the devil's advocate argument. Yeah. Then just scale it. And a good trainer will tell you to scale it and will make you scale it. Okay, that's true. But if you have someone, let's take me for an example, because that's a very easy example. You know, I'm not an exceptional Olympic weightlifter, had never done any Olympic weightlifting, had never done any gymnastics.
But your baseline level of fitness is way beyond the average person, way beyond the average person walking into a CrossFit gym.
However, I still don't have down all the movement patterns, and I still think it is annoying that it is supposed to be a competition of fitness. It's not a competition of fitness. It's a competition of technique, and it's a competition of you, because it's not the fittest on earth. It's the fittest gymnast, or it's the fittest Olympic weightlifter.
Right.
Because I can deadlift, you know, if I deadlift,
and this is what we were talking about. This is what we were talking about last night.
215, yeah. Then you'd think I would have a heavy snatch. Like I could snatch a lot of weight.
I still don't know what a snatch is.
A snatch is you take it from the ground and then overhead. Basically a deadlift into a press. So you'd think that that would be relatively easy, but it's not. It's particularly difficult. So
a snatch is an extremely athletic move.
Yeah.
It takes a lot.
A lot of mobility and a lot of biomechanics. If you look at top-level CrossFitters and Olympic weightlifters that go to the Olympics, it can be almost entirely predicted by limb length ratios.
Oh, and I've got short femurs.
You would be – I've now done CrossFit for more than 1 year, and if you dedicated a month or two to it, you would already be better than myself.
Well, you said it should take at least 6 months to build a base, so I think you're just trying to get me injured.
Well – you probably would
but
get injured
if you I'm the fast. Yeah, if I'm the average person, or even just me going into the CrossFit gym, and a trainer's like, I see CrossFit on TV, right? And I'm like, ooh, I want to do that.
Yeah.
These guys are swinging around on the bars, doing butterfly pull-ups.
Looking stupid, being like a floppy fish.
And then the trainer says, hey, hang on, let's go ahead and start here. Let's put you over in the CrossFit Junior class. I think a good percent of people are going to say, I don't want to do CrossFit Junior. They're going to go pay for another gym that lets them do the, you know, cool stuff. So I think that's where you have this sort of balance. And a good trainer is probably able to balance and strike that and keep people relatively safe. But I think you probably have people that are pushing the envelope and letting people have a little bit too much slack and in terms of like progression. And then that's where these things can happen.
There's no reason to have butterfly pull-ups in any sort of functional fitness. Kipping, I can somewhat understand because that is like, it is relatively functional. Because if you're trying to climb up a wall, then you can kind of kip a little bit as you climb up a wall or whatnot. But there's zero function for butterfly pull-ups, especially when you take the strain off the grip with these different gymnastic grips.
Well, you know, it's funny you said that in particular because sometime in the past month or two, my wife and I were talking about it. And my wife was a pretty good gymnast in her youth. And she basically said just what you just said. Like the butterflies, she's just like, why? But the kipping, she can kind of relate to.
Yeah. Yeah. To be clear, I do still prefer strict movements for many reasons, including building strength. But if you're arguing from a functional fitness standpoint, if you're just thinking about a fitness standpoint, then I suppose there's not really any reason for kipping. But even if you look at calisthenic athletes, when they do their pull-ups, then yeah, their feet are kind of coming down a little bit in front of the bar and they go up. So they're not doing pull-ups straight up and down. They're doing their pull-ups at an angle.
Yeah, but I think let's say – for some reason, you were holding a competition for who can do the most of those angled chins.
Endurance calisthenics.
Yeah. So the person who trains with traditional strict form chins.
Yes.
They will be the person that can switch over and they will win that competition over people that are training this way.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Or people that are butterfly training. Or did we just make that illegal?
Yeah,
and now people aren't going to be doing that anymore.
That's certainly illegal. Yeah, I do wonder how some elite calisthenic athletes would do at a less or at a better version of CrossFit or functional fitness.
I kind of think they'd probably do. I think they'd probably do pretty good,
yeah.
Pretty well.
I don't know all their names, but I know Max True is a pretty famous one that's known for his endurance calisthenics, where he's doing calisthenics, you know, squats, dips, muscle ups, et cetera, et cetera. Somewhat strict. And he's still, you know, there's still not a perfectly, he's not swinging, but he's definitely using momentum from one side of the bar to the other side of the bar. Everyone does. That's just the natural movement pattern. But I think he would do quite well if there was no kipping and no butterfly. But there's a lot of other things that he probably wouldn't do as well. He probably wouldn't be good at snatching and clean and jerking. So again, it's if you're thinking about the fittest person or the best technique, something like Hybricon Games or High Rocks. Hybricon Games is Battle Bunker. It used to be called Battle Bunker. That seems like a more accurate assessment of just fitness with removing most of technique.
Well, I mean, they probably wouldn't do that well in Olympic lifting, because I don't think that kind of training develops power. And most people don't understand, I know you guys do, but most people don't understand that powerlifting is completely misnamed. It has nothing to do with power. It's brute strength, right? Whereas Olympic lifting is a test of power.
Yep.
So I don't know if you're, I'm purely speculating, you know, but I kind of think if you were a high level calisthenics athlete, that wouldn't necessarily translate into power.
Mm-hmm. A lot of field athletes in track and field do make great Olympic weightlifters, maybe not in their weight categories, but if you look at a discus thrower, shot putter, javelin thrower, hammer thrower, a lot of those individuals can move a lot of weight
quickly
in a snatch and clean and jerk.
Yeah.
Within a couple months of clean and jerking, I think Maddie was hang power clean, something like 240. So a lot of them can move weight naturally and easily because the training carries over. And also they're doing a lot of front squats. They're doing a lot of strict presses. They're doing a lot of deadlifts.
When you're sort of selecting for that too. So you have the people that were the strength athletes in probably middle school, high school, and then college. And they're just naturally very good at that. They can have a lot of power output. And then you just take that and apply it where there's a different technique, not necessarily more or less technique, but a different technique, and they do exceedingly well.
Most of the field events are power events in track and field. Yeah. There's some component of, absolute strength as well.
Do you ever throw the javelin or shot put?
Only for fun. I do wonder what I could do now compared to when I was 30 pounds lighter, much lighter, but quicker and faster.
Yeah, you probably throw significantly farther now.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I would.
Maybe we'll do a, instead of the Gillette Health Army Fitness Test, maybe we'll do a track and field games next year.
There is a 10-pound medicine ball throw where you, in the ACFT, the Army Fitness Test, where you take the 10-pound medicine ball and you throw it above your head like this. So that is one of the events tomorrow. It's a power event. Standing power throw is what it's called.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, they should add that to CrossFit instead of snatches. They can keep clean and jerks, but only because I'm good at them.
There you go.
How heavy can they make the medicine ball? Or maybe it's just a kettlebell. That sounds too much like the strongman stuff then.
Will they carry their big granite ball?
Yeah. No, a sick combination would be like High Rocks or Battle Bunker plus all the strongman events. Because if you're thinking about High Rocks or Hybricon Games, which is Battle
Bunker, you run in between
a whole bunch of running, which again, just because I happen to be good at running does not mean that I should make everybody else run, because it's like, you're like, oh, this is a fitness test. You can't design it to what you're good at. You got to design it of what is going to be the best net positive for individuals. And to be clear, we're also talking about the sport, the methodology of whatever. You know, there's plenty of people who get no enjoyment out of, you know, progressing and eventually being good at what they do, that are okay doing hyper scaled CrossFit, for lack of a better term, and just always being scaled. They're like, oh, it's okay to be scaled, like get the training stimulus. And it's like, well, it's also okay to play basketball and always be horrible at it and never learn the technique, but I enjoy trying hard at things that I do. Like, it's different. I would say it's okay not to win. Whatever you're a professional at, then you want to try to win. At health optimization, yes, I am distraught if I do not absolutely win. But in my hobbies, I'm okay if I don't win, but I still want to do well.
I think you still want to win.
Yeah, you should have seen him on the pickleball court.
I would rather win.
I can imagine.
But it's not something that you're going to train for extra. So if there's something that I don't know in practice, then yeah, for the next week or two, we'll probably do a podcast on it. Actually, we'll do a bunch of journal searches and whatnot, and become an expert in that. Whereas if I don't win at a CrossFit competition or pickleball or game of volleyball, then I'm probably not going to be,
just mildly enraged
doing pickleball drills. So,
yeah. Are there pickleball drills?
He knows. He's looked.
I assume. No. I've never done any pickleball drills. I think I've played three or four times. I really like the tactile, swinging of the pickleball. Because if you're there's just something about swinging a racket or a bat that's fun. And the good thing about pickleball is it doesn't go too far, so you don't have to chase after it.
Yeah. Compared to softball or baseball or something like that, that other people have leagues of. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, you don't have to be necessarily good or even particularly athletic to enjoy a little bit of pickleball.
Yep.
So there's a lower barrier to entry on a fitness level than something like tennis.
Well, I assume it exists in the Midwest and elsewhere as well, but in the Northeast where I live, there's a backlash against pickleball.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because tennis players are angry that pickleballers are taking over their courts, and people who live next to the court say that pickleball is really loud. You know, I have zero horse in this race. Like, I'm just saying.
It actually, this, this came to a head during the Super Bowl. They had the commercial that pickleball was tennis for babies. I don't know if you guys saw that one, but that was a Super Bowl commercial. So I
this
think
last,
there has
this
been
last
a,
year?
Yeah, this most recent one.
Tennis and pickleball are both volleyball for babies.
There you go. There you go. That discussion is done.
That's funny. Yeah, here in the Midwest, people love pickleball, and I've never heard anything negative about it.
Yeah, Overland Park, I think, is a hub of pickleball, like the most pickleball courts per capita, or some bizarre statistic like that.
Yeah.
So we sort of live in a pickleball bubble.
Yeah,
I suppose.
I don't mind it whatsoever.
Can I?
It is loud. I can't hear the haters over all the pickleball racket.
Can I tell a volleyball story?
Sure.
It's not relevant to anything. It just popped into my head when you brought up volleyball. So many, many years ago when I was in high school, probably at least 1 year, maybe even closer to 2 years of my life was spent in a high school that was being actively renovated. So there was construction going on a lot. And our gym areas were under construction. And, you know, I don't know, again, like I'm an old man, but like we did gym all year, but we would rotate through different activities. And because of the construction, we could not rotate. So all we did for one solid year was play volleyball. And the interesting thing is, though, like at the very beginning, there were the athletes spiking and the little girls who hung out in the library standing like this while the ball bounced by them. Because it was nothing but volleyball, by the end of the year, we were having savage volleyball tournaments. Like wow. Everybody in the class. The little girls that used to stand like this, they were, I mean, everybody was involved. And it, just because we had nothing else to do, we just played volleyball all year. And by the end of the year, everybody was playing good volleyball. It was pretty savage.
Yeah, that's nice. We've been through a volleyball phase. Well, not I don't think you have.
No, I have not. I may have played like some pool volleyball or some beach volleyball very sparingly or rare. Like, I think I understand the rules. It's pretty simple. But as far as calling myself a like going through a volleyball phase, probably not.
I don't think you have.
Not on my volleyball arc.
Yeah. Volleyball and pickleball
you
are
still
both
have time,
social.
James.
It's not too late.
That when in regards to movement pastime that lasts a lifetime, I think there's a lot of merit to having a social activity. If someone is not as social of a person or they're more introverted, then perhaps not. But for everyone, having at least some degree of social interaction, that's one thing that gym classes are good for, any sort of fitness class. One thing they're not good for is a lot of times they're, Pilates or bar or yoga or things that are not optimal for either resistance training or cardiovascular training. And they're very hard, so you're tired, so you don't train the other things. Not that they don't have merit, they do. But they do have a social component, which is why a lot of people are very consistent doing those things. Same thing with volleyball. Volleyball leagues are fun and people enjoy doing them. Yeah. Not that those are my recommended movement pastimes. Anything that you can be consistent with is still good. That was kind of a nice tangent from CrossFit.
Yeah, that flowed particularly well. Yeah.
I think that's most of the things that are on our list. So unless we have anything else, we could wrap up.
Yeah, we've covered a lot of ground across a lot of different aspects. We've talked about ER, hormone clinics, cookie cutters, our own practice. We've heard some stories, Dr. Egan.
Medical education.
Given a lot of opinions and not a lot of medical advice.
Yeah, zero medical advice. Zero individualized. Yeah, we never give medical advice. We don't know what patient we're talking about, so it's literally impossible to give medical advice.
And it would be irresponsible to do that, actually.
Maybe we can change the intro instead of just a balanced approach to health. This can be the podcast where we give you a balanced approach to health and no medical advice.
I like
a nice,
it.
Smooth disclaimer, too.
I like it.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.